at GBQ, we're always counting. Now we're making your time count with this episode of Empower Hour. Start the clock. Welcome here today with Empower Hour and Lisa Pack McDaniel, CEO of the Workforce Development Board. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
So you are the first guest I've had that I've known for 38 plus years. Usually it's a stalk the LinkedIn and read profiles online to find out. And as we've had fun getting ready for this, there's a whole list of things that we won't talk about that go all the way back to college.
No, we will not.
We will not. I will let you pick up where we left off. But looking back in our history, we met freshman week at Miami University. I believe our corridors were paired together back in the day when men and women were in different buildings.
Right.
And then ended up being in the same program, the public administration program at Miami, took classes together, interned at the City of Lebanon together, ended up the same graduate school at the Ohio State University. I have to say you're the proud bearer of the public administration experience. You got a degree in the field and you've been in the field your whole career. Me, I said, not for me, and jumped into technology. So from where we left off at Ohio State, get me from that and to your path to the Workforce Development Board and focused on job issues.
Great. Well, hey, let me just remind you that you're the one who dragged me to the meeting about public administration.
Oh, I forgot that.
Yeah, you did, because I was majoring in political science because I wanted to write about it. And instead, you said, come to this meeting with me about public administration. So yet again, another reason why you've had a huge impact on my life.
Well, then I'm gonna just claim the other one right now, since you alluded to it. Dana McDaniel, who's your husband, is your husband because of an introduction that I made too. So
yes,
I'm going to lay claim to all kinds of things on this broadcast.
And I'll gladly give you the credit. So public administration, public service, that's what I fell in love with after getting into the public administration program, because that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about long-term public service. I initially got involved through politics. I got a job at the state after working on Dick Celeste's gubernatorial campaign. I thought originally I wanted to work with local governments at a state level, look at policy, but I eventually migrated over to community and economic development at the Ohio Department of Development. And I loved going all over the state. I swear I've been in more communities than any governor has ever been in when they've been running for office. I loved seeing different parts of the state. You know, I grew up in Northeast Ohio. I'd never been in a house where there was still a dirt floor, a particularly moving and emotional thing for me when I was a 25-year-old. And then I got into more economic development and doing deals. And there's a lot of excitement to that. You know, you're working all the time and you're negotiating. And then you do the deal and then you walk away. And you never really look at what happened after that. But I did a particular deal with a company that was over in Delaware County. And the guy wanted to not move their company, some additional work they had, to Mexico. That's what corporate wanted to do. And he felt like there were probably places in Ohio where at the right price point, they could do the same work. And I ended up convincing them to go down to Ironton, Ohio, into an abandoned building that we'd actually built for a computer, a chip maker, believe it or not. And when I went down there, I finally met him once they had moved in, and a manager came up to me and thanked me, because it makes me emotional. His wife, he'd been out of a job because he had lost his job at two of these major employers had left. And his wife had cancer, and he was able to work for this company, had a great job, became a manager and had insurance. And I literally had to walk off the floor, go to the restroom, because it's the first time that it dawned on me how I never really saw what happened at the end of economic development. So I eventually migrated to workforce development because I thought that that was a really good mix of working with employers, but also working with employees. And so I did that at development, and then I accidentally became the director of development. That's what I like to say. I never could have imagined when I started at the front line in development that someday I would end up to be the director and on the governor's cabinet. So that was a really great experience for me because I knew that department like the back of my hand, and I could name everybody in the department. So that was really great. But the work I did there across development, in my opinion, development, economic development, workforce development, community development, and housing, those are all a three-legged stool. If you don't have all three of those working well together, your community is not going to be successful. And so I was one of the few people who've been blessed to have worked in each one of those policy areas. And I think it served me well when I was director. Then after that, I went to do housing policy with Ohio Capital Corporation for Housing. I love to do that. We were working really with affordable housing, helping communities navigate that. And that I say navigate because there's a lot of NIMBYism in affordable housing, but there's a huge need for it. You know, from there, I went to the Affordable Housing Trust here in Franklin County to stand up their community development bank. So relying back on my loans I used to do for economic development and my community development policy. So I did that. This job came open. And actually, when I left the state, I had stood up the workforce division for development. I really liked that work. I was really jazzed about it. When I left the state, there really wasn't a place to do that kind of work. And so that's why I went back into policy work. But when this job came open, I literally did a turnaround because I was working, thinking I would continue to do this community development, economic development, loaning. I went, nope, this job is open. And I really had a passion for this. And so I threw my hat in, and here I am.
It doesn't surprise me because you've always had a passion for the people part of any equation. That I know you've been involved in a lot of different nonprofits and social interested or socially focused groups, and it's always been about the people for you. So it doesn't surprise me. It surprised me that you got involved in loans and economic development stuff because I don't think that was something you ever talked about when we were in college. I think just as a kind of a bookmark that doesn't mean anything to most people, but probably to us, and maybe it does, is that you were thinking about journalism. I was thinking about public administration. I'm now probably the core of what I do is helping our clients navigate the crazy regulations that sometimes impede progress that have been put in place to protect information and privacy and all of those types of things. And then you were thinking about journalism, and you think about the journalism professions being dramatically changed.
Right.
The only job that's dramatically changing. And my what I'm doing, we never would have thought about it. Miami, I think it was our sophomore year, was the first year for computer science.
Right,
We had a good friend, and I will send him a link, but we won't mention his name for no other reason than it's not fair, who was a systems analyst, and he was my roommate, and he brought all these cards to the room because of that's how we programmed back then.
Right.
I didn't do that. And you think about all the changes that have been made, and it's been hard for people to keep up and adapt, which I know is part of this workforce development piece. When I started thinking about doing Empower Hour, GBQ has this really unique vantage point. There were some businesses that are continuing to do really well. We're working with a firm right now that actually started up to help companies navigate the whole landscape of social distancing and personal protection. There are firms that I like, High Bank Distillery, and one of the things that they did was they pivoted a little bit and started making hand sanitizer. Mm-hmm. There are other Rogue, I think, pivoted some. There's other businesses that we work with that pivoted. And then there's others that not so well. All three of my sons went to Miami, so we'll bookmark that. But two of my sons were still in college and working to earn their cash, the cash part that they needed in food service, and they were coming home with crazy stories. And so it was like, there's a haves and haves nots problem. And to me, I've said this before, it's a math problem. We have people that are doing really well. If we could find a way to take those people that help those people that aren't doing so well, the market gets bigger. So we all ought to be focused on that, regardless of where it's at. I hear, you hear, people don't want to work. And I think it's a much more complicated function or piece than that. I know that your passion, I'm going to push the passion button with Lisa, that you don't agree with that statement. So go explain why.
Yeah. So for one thing, if I had even a quarter for every time somebody has said to me, people don't want to work, even before the pandemic, I would be wealthy. I wouldn't have to play the lottery for sure. And that it is much more complicated than that. And the pandemic ripped the Band-Aid off of things we were talking about right before the pandemic, right? Why it's difficult for people to get into the workforce place, what the skills mismatch is, why it continues to be in place, you know, the ability of people who, you know, are working two jobs at low wages to step away from that to get a credential. Well, and how are they going to pay the bills? I mean, that's why they're working the two jobs, right? You know, the ability for transportation, childcare, and we can go on. The pandemic happens and that rips it apart. Not only does it rip it apart for those lower wage workers, but it rips it apart for a lot of, you know, mid to even higher paid people, especially women. So, because many women became caregivers, made the choice to step away from whatever work they may have been doing. And then we can go down a rat hole with that as to why that was the woman who did that, but we won't do that here. So yeah, it is just much more complicated than that. And before the pandemic, Doug, exactly what you're saying, you know, I said at a chamber event once that, look, it is in every business person's best interest here to have become an employer of choice, to be paying a fair wage and fair benefits, because whatever your business is, whatever it's contributing into the economy, right? Somewhere down the line, we're a consumer economy. And if people don't have the cash to buy services and goods, experiences, whatever it is, the economy does not work. And so as we have more and more have-nots, the haves, you can only drive. I mean, even, you know, I consider Dana and I a have for sure, right? I mean, we're privileged. I would be lying if we said somehow we weren't. We can only drive so many cars. We can only buy so much furniture, right? We can only go out to eat so many times. And that's true of everybody who has a discretionary cash. So at some point, you know, this economy breaks down. I would argue it's starting to break down because we need more people to be able to spend cash in a consumer economy. And if people aren't being paid well, they're not even being able to cover their basic needs, let alone be able to pay for any of the other things that are on top of those basic needs, right? So am I getting too passionate?
I did a few years ago. I did it. It informed me of a piece of this. I did a homeless walk with my church through the Short North, which I incidentally have since moved into.
Yeah.
Met a young man who was not homeless. He had been. He graduated from college. His parents were deceased. He didn't have a big family. Went to work for somebody. Turned out it was in a small rural town. Turned out it was a bad experience. A couple of bad experiences tied together. He lost his papers, his social security card, his birth certificate, and that sort of thing, and had no foundation to step from. College degree. He had encountered the folks at our church, and they had helped him. And it was simply just having the foundation to get not just credentials, but papers to participate. We don't think being in this spot where we're successful and we've done well, that there are people that don't have the necessary, just the basic foundation. That's one piece. And then you mentioned credentials. You right. know, if I want to cut hair, I need a credential. If I want to do nails, I need a credential. If I want to, just a whole laundry list of things, need credentials, and that takes money and that takes time. And what you're saying is people don't have the money and the time to earn those things, and they may want to work, but they can't enter the market they want to enter because of the barriers.
Or let me give you the other scenario. So we are doing a pilot with the Community Shelter Board right now. People are coming, families are coming to the shelter working. They have jobs. They can't afford the housing. Or one of the two workers in a home may have lost their position, or the person that may, if there's a single mom or single dad in the home, lost their position, and now they can't maintain the housing they have, and or they can't find housing that they can afford, and they're coming to the shelter. And before, you know, people's perception of people who are homeless as well, you know, they're not working, you know, they're suffering from a lot of issues. And that's true. There are a lot of barriers. People come to the shelter with a lot of other barriers. But we are starting to see people come to the shelter because they may be working and they can't find affordable housing. And so what we're doing is we are working with them to help them if they've lost employment, but they've had employment in the past. Those are the kinds of people that are a lot, I say, easy relative, right?
Right.
To help, right? But we, you know, we're working to help them get into a better, well-paid job and then into housing that they can afford and maintain over the long haul. Some of us can really just be a couple of steps away from not having what we need. And during the pandemic, I was on the board of the Dublin Food Pantry. I think you probably saw that. We were seeing people coming to the pantry, and we still are actually, who have never been in need of food ever and never could have envisioned themselves coming to that pantry needing food. And the pandemic did that because they, you know, people were riffed out of their positions because they aren't positions where people can work at home.
Yeah. And, well, I've seen yeah. some, so, but I'll just coin a term, self-rift. I'm a mom and my, you know, multiple kids won't sit and focus on Zoom all day unless I'm the taskmaster. So I have to walk away from my job. And so there's certainly that issue, but I think there's another issue too, that given the dynamics of the pandemic, there are people that have exited what they were doing because they've realized they don't want to do it anymore. I'm not going to go off the top of my head. I've seen some lists. And I think the restaurant industry is one. There are two or three restaurants right now in town that have closed. And hopefully by the time this broadcast is published, that they'll be reopened because they've been having trouble finding staff. And part of that is people are sick. But part of that is people said, food service, I'm going to go do something else. And there are other careers. Yes. We've had a bunch of retirees. Yes. From a business perspective, we know that the humans that work in your business are critical to your success, because if you don't have people to do the work, you can innovate and bring robots in, and you can innovate and use artificial intelligence. But at the end of the day, we still produce wealth with people. And
right.
So from an employer's perspective, how has things in your mind changed from an employer's perspective in terms of what they need to offer? And I guess in a general sense across the board, but what do they need to do to help enable their workers to have successful lives?
That's a great question. And I do, in this position, like I said, it's an interesting place because we're between employees and employers, right? And we need both to be successful. Again, I talk about employer being an employer of choice. So what's an employer of choice? An employer of choice understands that contract between the employer and the employee isn't one of dominance and subservience. It is one of equal. I'm bringing my particular skills, talent, energy, enthusiasm to your place of work to help produce whatever it is this place, you know, of work does. And so from an employer's side, to be an employer of choice, I think, first of all, that employer has to be clear about what the mission of what they are trying to accomplish so that they can sell that vision and mission to the employees and potential workers, number one. Number two, I mean, you really need to look at what is a fair wage. And you know what? In food service, we have some really great restaurateurs who care about their employees. But because of the nature of the business, you know, the margin there's one particular employer, and I won't mention her by name again, because it's not fair. But in having a conversation with her, she said, my margins are so thin. I'm paying as much as I can pay. Okay, so let's talk about job quality then, right? So job quality is, can I provide a schedule to an employee that the employee can rely on at least every 2 weeks? So an employee isn't finding out on Sunday night that their schedule is all over the place, because it's very difficult to provide childcare, get good childcare, right? That's just one. Let's just leave it at that. That's hard enough. And can we talk about, if I schedule you and then I have to send you home, maybe I can't pay you what I would have paid you if you would have worked the whole time, but what can I pay you as a premium because you did show up and now we're slow? Is there some way that I can reimburse you for that time? I think other larger companies, but still mid-level, and we're not talking about nationwide insurance, you know, when I look at my benefits, really, what are the benefits I can provide that really, really help employees? Maybe I should be looking at some kind of a reimbursement for childcare. Maybe I should be looking at, you know, depending on where I'm located, a transportation benefit. You know, maybe, you know, healthcare is a given, although that's another rat hole we could go down. I'd love to see healthcare. And I think some of my employers would love to see healthcare be divorced from the employment contract, because that's a huge cost for employers on their side. That's a pain point. But nonetheless, that's the only way right now, that's the primary way people can get good healthcare, right? Can we look at time off and sick leave? One of the interesting things, this was before the pandemic, I met with another company, who shall go nameless. They were enlightened. And those are the kinds of employers I love to work with. So they were paying a lower wage. But what was happening is they could not retain their employees. And what they discovered, when you sit back and look, well, what's really happening here, is that they had employees would start, but they did not earn any sick leave or time off for like 6 months. Okay, so the person comes in, they have their first kid get sick, right? And someone has to stay home with that child. And they're like, I can't stay home because I don't have sick leave. I guess I'm going to have to quit because I have to stay home. And instead of, you know, they get penalized if they would call off. And so, you know, if it happens more than once, and you know, you've had young kids, it definitely, when they're younger, can happen quite a bit in 6 months and leave. And so it dawned on them, you know what, we need to give them some leave right at the beginning so that they can use it and not be penalized for that. We need to provide them with, you work this long or you gain these skills, you can count on getting a raise for that. And they were able to improve their retention like upwards of 80% right away, just doing those things.
Well, and some of that has to come from truly knowing your employees. I had a firm, GBQ acquired my firm 5 years ago, a little bit over 5 years ago. At our biggest, we were 11, and it was very easy to be adaptable to individual situations. And, you know, there were a number of those people living lives, the issues come up, and it was very easy to be adaptable in a small firm like that. I think the big firms can programmatically do it because they have the cash. I think a lot of the mid-market feel constrained. Example where the margins are thin. There are other things that can be done. We're still at GBQ. We're still figuring some of this stuff out. We're basically hybrid. You got a job to do, get it done. Get it done where you can most likely get it done. Not a policy per se, because the minute you start writing policies, everybody starts asking about exceptions. But that's essentially the exceptions and details.
Sure.
But it's that know your employees and change that relationship. And in your, what you called your manifesto, which really wasn't, it was a bulleted list of things. You talked about changing that employment contract. And I think you've alluded to some of this. It's the, we both have things we each need. I need your help to deliver my good or service or build whatever I'm building. you need a foundation to live a life so that you can be successful, because it's not all about going to work.
Right.
Some employers around here, there's a big fast food firm that we work with that is known for extreme longevity of their workers, their store workers. And mm-hmm. so it's possible, but you have to really kind of roll your sleeves up and know your employees to be able to know what, it's not just money. It's not, I need more money. It's, I need flexibility. I need empathy. Empathy is a person to person's easy. Empathy in a HR program or benefits manual is probably harder to come by.
Right.
And so what else do you see with that employment contract changing or being necessary to change? You said it so succinctly before we started the recording. I'm going to cue it up and then you could say it, because you said you're going to say it better than me. But it's not that people don't want to work. It's that they don't want to work for, and you can finish the.
Yeah, I've told employers, some employers, right? It's not that employees don't want to work. They don't want to work for you. So let's talk about why they don't want to work for you. So, because those employees who are doing the things that you say that you've just listed, and where an employee feels the employer is invested in them, cares about them, wants to see them grow in their work. I mean, what employer, why would an employer not want to see their employees grow, right? Because the more they contribute, the more successful I am as an employer, right? And sometimes that means, you know, my attitude, I have a small staff of 14 at the board, not counting our job center. You know, I'm invested in them, knowing that there's only so far they can grow because we're small and they may leave me, but I'm okay with that. That's what I want. I want to see them grow, and I'm okay if I'm training them, they're with me, and then they need to grow bigger and they're going to go somewhere bigger. It is okay. But that's hard for an employer to get his or her head around that, you know, I'm going to invest all this and then they might leave. Yeah, they might, but they also might come back. Number one, but why you have them, they're really going to be giving you all of their energy, enthusiasm, knowledge, and skills. And that's, isn't that what you want, right?
Yeah, we've had some people leave and come back, the so-called boomerangs. They've come back because of culture. The grass is not always greener.
Right.
It is for some people. It isn't for everybody. And the ones that see the culture that fits them, they've come back. We've had employees say, I really want to work for you, but because of family conditions, I need to move to someplace. And we now have, it was unthinkable before the pandemic. So it's ripped the Band-Aid off in some ways, but it's also changed some vision in terms of what's there. One of the managers on my team is actually in Wichita. She works for us remotely. Most of our work is done on the keyboard in the IT services group. And so where doesn't matter so much anymore. We have clients today that still don't, we used to visit them all the time and they want us to do the work remote. And so that's certainly changing dynamics there. We've been able to adapt, and we're continuing to learn, what do the employees need? What do they want? And we've gone through a process of sitting down and listening to our employees. You know, what are you good at? What are you passionate about? And what do we need? And at a firm like GBQ, what do we need means, what do our clients need help with that you can contribute to?
Right.
And we found where that three circle Venn diagram, where we maximize that, people stay. People come to work, they're doing something they're good at, they have passion for it, and we're delivering a service that people need. That doesn't translate into every segment of the market, because sometimes there's jobs. I worked 2 years in a warehouse fulfillment center through college, and there was nothing I was passionate about there. My son worked fast food, and last year, and God love him, he's really creative. And he said to me, you know what, Dad, I really don't want to start working there. I want to find another job. That job doesn't fulfill me. I said, well, what fulfills me is you contributing to your college. And he went to work, and he's now changed, and he's enthused with work. You know, sometimes you've got to see those as stepping stones and then help people make those steps up, because they can't do it on their own.
No, you're exactly right. You know, while you were speaking, something that came across, one of the biggest changes as an employer that has made me laugh lots of times is, look at the state. Okay, the state agencies now, You know, when I first worked there, it was you sign in at 8, you take a 15-minute break, you have an hour lunch, 15s, and you leave at 5. And then, you know, by the time I left, we had flexibility. You can come in, you know, you work your 8 hours. We even got to a point where people could work 4/10s or they could work 6 hours a day, right? And make it up during the week. Now, because of the pandemic, and this is true for private sector employers, right? They said, oh yeah, we can't do it. We can't do remote work. No, but you, the public sector can't do remote work. Well, guess what? They're still doing remote work. And now some of these agencies are looking to permanently have remote work as part of the work that they do because, you know, number one, they found out they could do it and nothing fell through the cracks, or little through, fell through the cracks, depends on who we're talking about. Number two, you know, their employers are happier, employees are happier, and they have said, we'd like to continue to have this flexibility. I think they are, to me, one of the number one examples of before the pandemic, we said, well, we can't do this and we can't do that as an employer. But then during the pandemic, we found out we really could. And it hasn't actually more productive. In fact, my own staff, I've had to caution them about when we were fully remote. Now we are hybrid. You need to close your laptop down. And I want you to close it down. 5, 6, I don't want to see you on there. Of course, then you're going to say, well, how would you know if I was on there?
Yeah, well, it's, yeah, everybody on, but, the, on the, everybody listening had figured that out.
Yeah, but I also had to do it. I mean, people were incredibly productive, and I'd say they're incredibly productive now. Why is that? Because I trust them, because it's the work, right? You at GBQ, you're saying, we need the work. You know what you need to do. I'm going to trust you to do it, how you're going to best do it. And that's what we're going to talk about, whether the work gets done. Now, you've got places like who are in manufacturing, can't do that so much, right? People have to be
there
to do that. But there are other things employers have done. And I've worked with some employers who've really everything from, look, we're invested in your skills and you have the ability to, we're going to provide the training for you. You take it on your own time, at your own pace. And as you get it, you're guaranteed a raise it once you complete this and you're guaranteed it, right? Those employees, they're being paid, I would say, a pretty fair wage, a pretty good wage. And they have the ability and they can see it. It's transparent how they move up the chain and they stay because they feel that the employer is invested in them and that they are respected. And that's what the contract's about, right? Mutual respect. But, you know, an employer needs to be respected too. You know, if I've got the ability to hybrid, I can't, like, you know, not do what's expected of me, not give
I don't need
all
to do the work today because I've got this Call of Duty match. I think that well, first off, I swore when I was putting together my notes for this that I would prevent the two of us from sounding like old people. But back in the day, we were in college. Most of our fellow students were in college because we were going to get a job, and we were going to work, most of us, in a cube farm, and that most of us were going to stay in that job for the majority of our career. And I don't know what the number is, but you've had multiple whistle stops. I've had multiple whistle stops. Most people are going to. And the trend over time, the other thing that was true then was that most firms did everything for themselves. And pre-pandemic, well before the pandemic, we were in a spot where we said, you know what? I'm not so good with IT. I'm going to find a managed service provider. I'm not so good with payroll. I'm going to find a payroll provider. I'm not so good with benefits management, marketing, you know, run the list. So we were already set to work, have functions outside of our business. But then the pandemic hits in and suddenly our people can be outside of the business. They don't all have to report to duty every day in the office, like the state example and like the example here at GBQ. I think that we're still learning about accountability. We're certainly learning about security. We have a lot of our clients that set those work from home environments up pretty quickly. Suddenly confidential data and Minecraft on the Xbox are on the same network. You know, those kind of things need to be addressed and worked through. And then it's your term again from your manifesto, your list of bullets that we all talk about this work-life balance, and you think about it as an integrated life. But that's really what you're talking about. The hey, you got a life to live. Shut your laptop.
Yes.
Get your work done. Shut your laptop and live your life and do it all together in a mix.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. Because I have the opportunity to mentor students at Ohio State in their master's program, but others as well. And I always say that, first of all, work is only a part of your life. Work balance makes it sound like work is somehow not a part of your life. And it is. And so it behooves you as a person, as well-adjusted person, right, to find something that you are passionate about. And I do think that's part of the great resignation right there, is when you're sitting at home, you have a lot more time to think, and people are thinking, is this really what I want to do? And if it's not, why have I been doing it all this time? And if it's not, what is it I want to do and how do I get there? You know, I've come across a lot of people who have made those thoughts and made the jump and didn't know where they were jumping to yet, right? But I think life, that's, you only get one, or right, as our kids probably say, YOLO, you only live once, right? And you do only live once. And so it's on you to make it the most meaningful, impactful, fulfilling life for you. And work has to fit in there and contribute to that. It shouldn't be something that, God, I work to live. And it shouldn't be, I live to work. It should be, this is my life and I do this because I like doing it, or I'm passionate about it, or it fulfills this in me, you know? And I think that's incredibly, incredibly important. And I think the employer actually, as part of that contract, has a clause that says, and I'm going to honor the fact that the work I'm having you do for me is a part of your life. It isn't your life.
So switching gears a little bit, you know, we used to think about working for an employer, and now some people are actually doing quite well. You know, back in the day it was freelance, and now it's these gig jobs.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, I look at my middle son who was working food service and cranking the hours at an appropriate time in his life. He was actually having a lot of fun too. Picked up a couple gig jobs. I forget the app he used, but one of the neighborhood apps, and he built a chicken coop. And the craziest story was he actually watched somebody's cat when she was on vacation. And every night he had to go FaceTime the cat so that the woman could talk to her cat. So he's got some crazy stories, but the, you know, the DoorDash and the Lyft and the Uber, the Fiverr, you know, there's all these, some
right,
using professional skills and other using just really labor. I realize your workforce development activities don't focus on that, but where do you see that as either a positive or negative, those gig jobs fitting into people's lives?
So I think that's a great question. So I think there are positives, right? There are positives on the side of, if you're working in the gig economy, you are deciding when you work, what you work, who you're working for, and you can more fully integrate it. However, I do get concerned on the negative side, especially for our younger workers who right now maybe don't think they want the things that maybe you and I wanted, assets, family, kids, and they're like, what, they don't want to, you know, work for the man, you know, those kinds of things. And they want to gig it. The issue there is the way our economy is structured right now for the long term is if you're only working in the gig economy and you're working those jobs that may not help you get those assets, may not, and if you don't understand about savings for farther down the road, you know, it can hurt people's long time, you know, when they're 40, 50, and they're looking at retirement, they won't have built up the assets. So that's one concern I have. I also am concerned, and we've already seen this in the beginning, you know, Uber was the thing to do. It's great. I could pick it up. You know, I can make extra money if I need to make it, or if I'm between jobs, I can do that. But even over time, right, these workers started banding together and wanted to be seen as employees. And I laughed a little bit to myself because I thought, isn't that what you were trying to get away from? But now you're saying, yeah, Uber, you owe me though. There's a contract there and I'm not getting enough on your side of the contract, right? But I do think there's a lot of positives for gig work for certain periods in a person's life, or if people are pursuing something that, you know, they do need to work and do some things on the side, but they're pursuing something else. But I'm not sure yet that gig work for the long haul for an entire career is the right answer for people. And maybe this is again where I'm starting to show me getting old, because I just worry about the ability, long-term ability of people to build wealth and assets for themselves that way.
Well, I think some of it comes to what kind of gig work. If I'm
absolutely
doing delivery, right. If I'm doing delivery and that sort of thing, I'm really giving my time. If I'm, you know, you go back to, I've thought about writing too, and I guess doing Empower Hour makes me an amateur journalist. I don't know, but that, you know, journalism has changed, and now so many writers do gig work, and there are writers that the creative people,
right.
I guess we'll go broader, that they actually do quite well at creating wealth for themselves. And it's hard to start a business, the right selection of gig work.
You're right.
And then the other thing is there's a Reddit called Beer Money. And Beer Money is all about doing gig jobs that don't take a lot of time to earn beer money. I rode an Uber. My car was broken down when I lived in Hilliard, and I dropped it off at the shop there and rode downtown to work with a guy who worked at Nationwide right next door. And every day he picked somebody up on his way to the office, and every day he took somebody home. And all he was worried about was paying the gas for the commute, and he made a little bit extra money. And that was, you know,
yeah,
it was gas
awesome,
money,
right?
Not beer money. But yeah, I think the gig economy is interesting. As the organization starts to happen in it, like the example you gave, as, you know, states try to find ways to tax it, at least at the state level, we're seeing some of that.
Or to
limit people's ability to enter that market. I mean, it's certainly going to change, but it's certainly it's a part of how to integrate work and life is the reason that I thought to ask it.
No, so I agree with you. I just want to say too, and you know, before gig work became a thing, we actually did, right? We had a lot of people doing consultants. That's gig work. You know, you're right. Creatives who are creating and then, you know, selling the piece, they're working for themselves. So you're right. It just depends on how it's structured. But, you know, when you asked me about it, what I was really thinking about, though, is, you know, the lower wage, the delivery people and that, you know, that kind of gig work.
Well, that's certainly getting twisted. If I've got a car and I'm putting all that mileage on my car, am I really taking into account the true cost of my work activity?
Right.
And, you know, sometimes some of those folks don't have the skill to make those calculations, even at a rough level. So I agree. That's a whole issue, but it certainly touches people. But if I'm working a job and doing two gigs, then my integrated life probably isn't all that.
No. Great. Right. 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 You're working to barely live. That's what you're doing. So
Lisa and I and a group of people at Miami University used to stay up at ridiculous times of the night, but we didn't do it in the dorms because I was thinking back then the dorms locked at 12 o'clock and it was completely forbidden that men and women were allowed to be in a dorm, even in like the living room talking. So it must have been at,
that's right,
at bars. And I know we had a woman who grew up in Oxford and we went over to her house some.
Yes.
And talked forever.
Gosh.
We're at the end, but I know there were some other things that you had on your list that we haven't touched on. Anything you're passionate about in this workforce area that we haven't touched on? Have I not asked a question I should have asked?
Yeah, you didn't ask me about what I felt about the minimum wage. I guess that's something I feel.
Well, let's do that. Let's hit
about.
That, because that's a big one, and it's a it can get to be a fiery one.
Yeah,
so you throw your voice out there into the conversation.
Well, I think people assume that I would be very passionate about setting a minimum wage And I'll tell you that I actually surprise people because I'm not. And it, I understand, you know, people, what has happened is people have picked $15 somehow as $15 is some magical number. What we know, the Women's Fund did a study a few years back, and what they found is that a single mom with two children really needed to be making $26 an hour to just meet her basic needs. And at the time, we said, it's not like she's going shopping at Easton. Now we would say that, and everybody's like, yeah, not many people are going shopping at Easton.
Right, exactly.
Now. But so what worries me about saying, you know, passing these minimum wage laws is that we are setting a bar that just becomes the newest low, right? And it goes back, it kind of ties back to what we started with, which is there's a contract between an employer and employee. And right now, employees have a lot more power. I don't think that power is going to fade, honestly, because especially in Ohio and the in the US in general, we are not producing enough of a population for all the jobs we've got. And I don't see that, you know, we have immigration, that's a whole, again, and a whole nother rat hole. We're not bringing people, enough people in also to work for these jobs. So that contract is going to be a lot more, it needs to be equal, right? Employer, employee, more balanced. And in that, then employers, employees will be able to shop around for who's going to pay what they feel their talent and skills are worth. And so I do think that there's room for employers to reassess what they're paying as a fair wage for the skills that they're doing. It's probably, it could be, and in many cases, many employers are laughing and saying, yeah, if I pay $15 an hour, I'm not going to get, I'm paying 19, I'm paying 21, you know, in 26. And now it's probably even a little more than 26 with inflation. You know, that's what the minimum wage is needed to actually survive in this, in Central Ohio right now. And so I just want to bring that up because I think that also plays into that employee-employer contract. On the other hand, there are employers who are paying below 15 that probably should be paying more. And those are the ones who come to me and say, I can't find workers. And I say, I can't help erase math in people's heads. You know, they right now, employees, job seekers can find jobs that pay them much more over the $12 you're offering. And I can't go to that person and erase the math in their head and convince them to come work for you. I can't.
Right, right. So, and that's true of whether, you know, there's good culture and integrated,
integrated
life, yeah. But it's still a function. It can't just be money, because we're seeing that people are leaving because the job activity's awful, or, you know, they don't want to do what they were doing. In some cases, no amount of money is going to change that. So then the job's got to be redesigned, or the expectations, how we manage people, the culture in the organization, because it's not just a money thing. But that's a very important comment about the money piece. If somebody's working for me and that's their life sustaining job, that we don't want them working two jobs because they're going to be tired and make mistakes and that sort of thing.
Right.
Same token, it's a challenge for employers because of the, you know, the profit calculation, and it's a difficult thing. We get asked a lot because, you know, I run the IT services department, and thankfully we don't talk about a lot of IT when we get on this, on these calls or these, these podcasts, but, you know, the fear of artificial intelligence and robots removing people from the workforce. But what we're really seeing right now is a trend to redesign jobs, make jobs better, make the people that are working for us more productive. And so you can certainly innovate, and that doesn't change the pay. That's a different conversation. But innovate and make the job a better job, one that's not the one that's not injury prone or boring or many other things that prevent people from wanting to work. And so there's a whole calculation there. And employers really need to think. I agree with you. I think the power, it's a seller's market, as they say, in the labor market, and that's going to stay with us for some time. And so the buyers need to really think about the full calculation of what they're offering in the transaction. Is at the end of the day, we talk about it as a business transaction. It's, am I paying enough? Does my culture support the kind of lifestyle and the integrated life that my employers or my employees want to have? Am I attracting with that the kind of people that match with my culture, the brand that I present? Is that who I want to be as a company? And that goes well beyond the where's my market? Who do I sell? Are my books in balance? And it's going to take some work in the business community for us to really be that I'm an employer that people want to work for.
Yeah. It's like the interview you did with Haley, the story, you know, a company has a story. They got to live the story they're telling is what I got. You know, if you're an employer and you say, this is what you stand for, you've got to be living that in your brand, in the way you treat your employees, in the way you provide your service, or it's not authentic. And that's the other thing. People want an authentic experience. They want to deal and buy from authentic producers of services and goods. And that's true for your employees too. Employees want to work for an authentic employer.
And Haley had, I'm glad you brought that up. Haley had a little bit of inside ball there. GBQ several years ago went through a process of saying, who are we? And came up with the brand statement that we empower growth. We empower growth in our employees, our community, and our businesses, the firms we work for. And it's very true. I've been astonished, you know, having worked for so many years, some of the things that I've seen here at GBQ on a people level, in terms of how we help others. And that's part of where we think that culture is, that others ought to kind of follow that. What Haley's saying is, you know, tell your story, but make sure that story is authentic.
Right, right, right.
So part of your story, and again, we could talk for hours.
I know. I'm sorry.
No. It's not an apology thing. When we were in grad school, we used to go to a bar and talk grad school talk. Dana, your husband, and I live two blocks from it now. And we've talked about a launch party after this thing goes. So I will see you shortly after that. But before you go, we're at what we call the final countdown. I have five questions for you. We're just going to go through them quick, kind of machine gun style, and you've got answers. So what did you dream of becoming when you were in middle school?
I wanted to be a journalist. My uncle bought me the Columbia Journalism Review subscription. I read it cover to cover starting in about sixth grade.
Who inspires you?
Oh gosh, so many people inspire me, but I will tell you that the one who inspires me the most right now is my husband. He's looking at retirement. I look back at his career as a public servant and with two public service jobs, basically being in the National Guard and the city of Dublin, and his leadership really inspires me. And I think, he's the one who inspires
me. Dana is an inspiring person, but I have to let the entire world know that of the three of us, he's the older one.
He is the oldest. Yes.
So anyway, moving right along, what is your favorite life hack?
My favorite life hack is spending 30 minutes in the morning. I call it planning time. It's when I sit and I think about what I got to do for the rest of the day, you know, trying to be intentional about the decisions and actions I take during the day. And the days where I get up late or I'm running, I feel it the rest of the day.
So the next question, I know enough about you that if you don't get it right, I'm going to throw some others out there that I think might be better suited for the answer, but not really. What has been your most valuable failure?
Not having had a conversation with you in a long time.
Oh, that's sweet. And I totally agree. It's really all about people. I think you said earlier on that we all die at some point. And so, yeah, we got to keep people that mean a lot to us close. So the end result of this podcast has been really interesting. I've met some wonderful people and then it looks like reconnecting as well. So finally, you work hard. How do you play to balance life? In your words, integrate work and life. So I'll let you answer it with the integration in mind, but how do you integrate your life?
I make sure that I'm intentional about what I choose to do, honestly. So the older I've got, the more I've realized that I'm doing some things and I don't really need to be agreeing to do them or going with those people. So The way I play is I spend time with people who matter to me. And that would be, you know, my husband, who's my best friend, you know, my daughters, my friends. I make sure I make time for them. There was a time in my career where I thought I had to be hard charging, all about work, working, you know. I don't want to say that that's why my career progressed, but in the old days, that is how your career progressed, unfortunately. But now, that is not the way I operate. I want to spend time with the people who matter to me and have long conversations way late into the night when I can, because I don't have kids to worry about. That's how I integrate my life.
Awesome.
And make sure I'm doing work I love. And I do that.
Good. Perfect. That's awesome. Well, who'd have known these two bright, idealistic kids would have ended up here? I'm thrilled we reconnected. I'm thrilled when this thing gets published out. And as soon as we stop recording, we'll figure out a date and time for the three of us to go to Max, which has been there in the short north for a very long time.
Yeah, it was one of the first places to show up there when the short north was transitioning from the kinds of places it had before.
Yeah, well, you'll
leave it at
that.
The kinds of places it is. Yeah, we'll just leave it at that.
All right. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you, Doug.
Time's up. Thanks for listening to this episode of Empower Hour. Join us next time by subscribing to Empower Hour on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your preferred listening platform. Want more GBQ? We don't blame you. Visit us online at gbq.com for the business news and advice that matters most. Who is empowering your growth?